Welcome to FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. I'm Nate Kazmarek, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federal Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of FedSoc Forum programs, become a Federal Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Hello and welcome to this FedSoc Forum webinar call. Today, September 24th, 2025, we're delighted to host the 2025 Ron Rotunda Memorial webinar, which this year will focus on judicial independence and the rule of law. Where we've been, where we're going, and what to do about it. My name is Kayla Kleist, and I'm Deputy Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's program, as the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. Now, in the interest of time, we will keep our introduction of our guest today brief, certainly more brief than their distinguished careers would deserve. So I highly recommend that if you're interested, you check out their impressive full bios at fedsoc.org. Today, we are fortunate to have with us as our moderator, Professor Michael McGinnis, who is a professor of law and the J. Philip Johnson Faculty Fellow at the University of North Dakota School of Law, where he joined the faculty in 2010 and served as dean from 2019 to 2022. Professor McGinnis's research and scholarship interests include lawyer and judicial ethics, constitutional law, especially First Amendment, separation of powers, and federalism, and cultural challenges faced by conservatives in law schools and the legal profession. Before joining the Legal Academy, Professor McGinnis served for 12 years as disciplinary counsel for the Supreme Court of Delaware. And I'll leave it to him to introduce our other speaker for the day. A last note before I get off your screens, if you have any questions throughout the program, please do submit them via the question and answer feature, likely found at the bottom of your Zoom screen, so they'll be accessible when we get to that portion of today's webinar. I'll ask that all questions submitted there, A, pertain to this discussion, and B, end with a question mark. With that, thank you all for joining us today. Professor McGinnis, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Kayla, and it's an honor to be here today to moderate this year's Ron Rotunda Memorial Webinar. He was an amazing scholar, amazing teacher. He wrote seminal law books that are still used in law schools across the country and was the author of over 500 law review articles, astonishing, and other legal publications that have been cited more than 2,000 times by law reviews, by state and federal courts at every level, by the U.S. Supreme Court, and around the world. He was also a member of the Federal Society's Practice Group on Professional Responsibility and Legal Education. And each year we hold an annual forum in his honor to discuss pressing issues and trends in legal culture. I also have a personal memory about Professor Rotunda over the years of memories. He was actually a great scholar while I was still in law school. In fact, my constitutional law horn book has Professor Rotunda's name on it, and I still remember that, how effective that was in helping me through those courses, but also over the years in the professional responsibility circles, being able to see and talk with him at ABA meetings and discuss issues, and just an amazing man, an amazing person. And so it's a delight to be here to participate in this honoring event. So joining us for the 2025 installment of the series will be the Honorable G. Barry Anderson. And he's going to offer his insights on judicial independence and the rule of law and the role of lawyers in supporting the rule of law. He will discuss how such support could be well demonstrated to clients when litigation does not go as they hoped. He will also address systems of judicial selection and their impacts on the independence and impartiality of the judiciary. Let me introduce Justice Anderson to give you some background, a very brief about his bio. It's impressive, incredible. 1976 graduate of Gustavus Adolphus College in St. Peter, Minnesota, and a 1979 graduate of the University of Minnesota Law School. He was a member of the Minnesota Court of Appeals from August of 98 until his appointment to the Minnesota Supreme Court. He joined the court in October of 2004 and retired from the court in May of last year. Prior to his judicial service, he practiced law in Fairmont and Hutchinson, was a partner in the law firm of Arnold, Anderson, and Dove. His civil trial experience includes personal injury and mechanics lien litigation, and he also served as the city attorney of Hutchinson for over a decade. So his background also includes substantial public service as a board member and chair of a variety of community organizations, including civic service clubs, task forces, and a local public access channel, as well as a wide variety of other community activities. He served several terms on the Minnesota Judicial Council, the principal administrative body for the Minnesota Judicial Branch. He also helped organize and served as a member of the Minnesota Citizens Commission for the Preservation of an Impartial Judiciary, chaired by former Minnesota Governor Albert H. Q. The commission considered issues relating to judicial selection, independence, and impartiality. after Justice Andrews has presented his remarks, we'll have an opportunity for what I believe will be a very engaging question and answer time. So please be thinking about your questions as we go through the presentation and put them in the Q&A, and we'll take a look at them and be happy to discuss them. So with that, we begin. Justice Anderson.
So much for that kind introduction, and I'm delighted to be with all of you today to talk about some of these rule of law issues. I want to say a word about Professor Rotunda, in whose memory we conduct this program. I had the privilege of serving with him as a moderator on a panel that he happened to be with. I happened to be on topics involving legal ethics, and as the introduction noted, Professor Rotunda's textbook on legal ethics is still available and still used, even though he passed away a few years ago. But my principal memory from that experience was how entertaining Professor Rotunda was in making some important legal points for the audience to consider. Regrettably, I lack Professor Rotunda's, both his facility with the technology, and I'm not nearly as entertaining, but we're going to try to manage both of those problems as we work our way through some rule of law issues. So let's get right to it and talk a little bit about some roots to the rule of law that we're going to be talking about today. So next slide, please. Next slide. We begin at the beginning, always a good place to start. When ordinary citizens think about the rule of law, they probably think about it in terms of a rule book, a volume of statutes that explain what it is they're supposed to do and how they're supposed to do it. And those kinds of rule books date back thousands of years. Most of us are familiar with the Hammurabi Code, which is probably about 1800 BC, but you can find scraps of similar codes going back much earlier than that, and in fact back to ancient Chinese law codes. And these codes do in fact set out law. There's contract law, how we should support or how residents should support widows. Crimes are all mentioned. And you can find lots of detail in these codes. One example that I often cite for those lawyers who do medical malpractice work, either plaintiff or defense, Hammurabi's code actually addresses one of those issues. For example, if a physician operates on a person of higher standing, social standing than the physician, and the patient dies, the penalty is to remove the physician's hand. On balance, I think I'd prefer malpractice insurance. But these codes are our first effort. But one of the things that characterizes these codes that is very different than the rule of law as we understand it is it is a top-down arrangement. In other words, the king, the ruler, the leader says, these are what the rules are. And if the rules become inconvenient, the king changes the rules or abolishes the rules or ignores the rules. And this is a very different framework than we are used to. Next slide. Here you have a photo of what that Hammurabi Code looks like, and also some of the commentary that I mentioned here about its top-down format. It is surprising how much of that ancient history we've preserved. Next slide. So let's talk about how we define the rule of law. And here I find the work of a legal scholar, actually legal philosopher, Brian Tamanaha, to be very useful. And I'm not saying this is the only definition, may not even be the best definition, but for purposes of our conversation today, we're going to work off of this particular framework. Rules that are stated in advance, rules that are known and accessible, and a provision for access to a fair and independent judiciary to enforce and reject application of the rules. And most importantly, keeping in mind what we had to say about Hammurabi and his cousins, rules that restrict both the sovereign and the citizen. Now, I want to say a word about the independent judiciary concept. Today, I'm talking to lawyers. And for lawyers, when they see an independent judiciary, they know what that means. They know that an independent judiciary incorporates and includes the concept of an impartial judiciary. When you talk to ordinary members of the public, it's sometimes a different story. And they look at an independent judiciary and they say to themselves, independent from who or from what. So my advice to all of us, when we go out and talk about the rule of law, and I'd be willing to bet many of you in the current culture and environment that we find ourselves in and have been in for a number of years, you probably get invitations to speak about what does it mean to talk about the rule of law. I recommend modifying somewhat what you see here and talking about a fair and impartial judiciary, because we all understand that and we all want that. When we walk into a courtroom, we want the judge, whoever he or she is, to be fair and impartial. So that would be the focus I think we should have instead of talking about independence. Lawyers are going to have to train themselves to not do that. Next slide. So then we turn to, what is the law? And for us in our environment, we want to talk about American law. Now, let's talk a little bit about constitutional law generally. When our Constitution was adopted in 1787, actually formally ratified, Rhode Island was the last state to ratify it. When it was formally ratified in 1788 and became law, it contains this provision, Supremacy Clause of the Constitution, which is interesting. But what's interesting about it is how unusual it was. And why do I say it was unusual? Let's talk a little bit about how the Constitution came to be. As we all know, there's a Constitution Convention in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Madison, Hamilton, Jay, many other founders are present, arguing about a variety of different provisions. But they include this provision in the Constitution. And what's interesting about this is that they themselves were actually citizens of different states. Madison of Virginia, Hamilton of New York, Jay, I think, was also New York. And yet they agreed to and sent to the convention and sent the work from the convention to the several states for ratification. Another interesting feature there is the fact that it is ratified by the citizens. It did not go to the legislators. It went to separate meetings designed to ratify the Constitution. Again, what does the Constitution start with? We the people. We know that. But this is really groundbreaking work that was done in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. The Constitution itself was recognized as a groundbreaking document by others of that era. For example, there were a number of countries in South Dakota that adopted, or South Dakota, South America. Maybe South Dakota did too. I guess we'll leave that aside. But the South America, there were countries in South America that adopted the Constitution. Adopted constitutions look very much like the United States Constitution. The Soviet Union, although it had other positive provisions, had three separate constitutions, all of which bore at least some similarity to what we know as our Constitution. And yet, almost all of those efforts failed. Our Constitution has survived. The rule of law that enforces the Constitution has survived. And then the question then becomes, why? And that's a really interesting question. Let's go to the next slide. And part of the reasons why it survives is that there were other factors at work to the rule of law than just simply a bunch of mostly smart people show up to draft a constitution, release it on the world, and say, here we go. There were other things that were in the background of all of this. We talk a little bit here about British common law, the Petition of Right, the English Bill of Rights, a lot of other provisions that you could mention. Declaration of Rights from multiple states. Multiple colonies, I should say, because they were colonies before they were states. And then colonial experimentation. Keep in mind that we had 100 years of experience in governing ourselves, because the English king, Great Britain, was a long ways away. Instructions might be sent to the leaders of the various colonies. Whether they were followed or not wasn't always clear. And in the end, Americans had their own courts and their own opportunities to experiment with leadership. And they were more than willing to do that. You know, I think we should mention here in the slide does a couple of other things. There were philosophical principles that were at work here in a way in which was unusual, separation of powers, which we'll talk a little bit more about in a bit. And then the Declaration of Independence. Big fight among academics in a variety of formats about the Declaration of Independence and whether it should be, in fact, viewed as a founding document or if it's simply that, a Declaration of Independence. And I'm with Lincoln on this. Lincoln very much treats the Declaration of Independence as not only an important, you know, document with equal standing with the Constitution. In some respects, I think you could argue he elevates it, that it's a declaration of principles that aren't necessarily followed, principles of human equality, for example, because the Constitution itself is an imperfect document and people are imperfect. But it is nonetheless a declaration of those principles. He writes separately in a fragment that we found post his death. He writes of the apple of gold being the declaration framed in the silver that is the Constitution. So as a practical matter, I think we have to view it as a founding level document, even if there's some argument about how effective it is. And of course, individual states had their own provisions there as well. Let's go to the next slide. So let's talk briefly. I've given longer expositions of the Magna Carta, but let's talk briefly about it because I think it does help explain some of our origin story here. But let me begin with a word of warning about the Magna Carta. And again, this is another topic that academics fight about. Well, we could have the professor talk about Dean and Professor McGinnis talk about these fights, but then this would turn this 45 minute to an hour podcast into several hours. So we'll just cover it briefly here to note that there's a pretty good argument that we overdo the comparisons to the Magna Carta. King John repudiated almost immediately and died soon after. It was an intra-elite argument. Nobody was asking the shop owners and the homeless on the streets what they thought about how power should be divided among the powerful. Although it makes reference to judgment by peers, they aren't talking about ordinary citizens. They're talking about the elites of that time. And there are also some provisions that are frankly pretty hair-raising. Provision limiting the rights of women to testify and frankly, anti-Semitic language dealing with the ability of Jews to collect some debts from underage debtors and some practical advice about fish traps that probably isn't much use to us now. But having said all of that, it's a remarkable document. And in many respects, the Americans make more use of it than the Brits do, which is why I mention it here. Next slide. So, Magna Carta has its, of course, is a British document celebrating about its 850th anniversary or thereabouts. But in the United States, it's treated as the first written limitation on the power of the ruler and influences what we come to talk about checks and balances and separation of powers, and once again enshrines the rule of law. Even leaders are bound by the law. Next slide. And we have not hesitated to cite it. The Supreme Court cited it over 170 times. You see there a variety of issues that have been addressed by the United States Supreme Court. And when I talk about it being something that is really rooted in American legal tradition, in a way in which I would argue it's not even rooted in the British legal tradition, although certainly regarded as significant, in about 1957, there had been no formal monument that had been created to the Magna Carta at Runnymede where it was signed. And such a monument, and I think I have the year right, maybe 56, 57 in there somewhere. I was three at the time, and I wasn't paying much attention to this, but that's what I read anyway. It was actually funded by the American Bar Association. It's the American Bar Association that puts up that permanent memorial to the Magna Carta at Runnymede, and not the British solicitors or whatever. So when I say we found it to be more significant in some respects than the Brits, that's an example of that. Next slide. And this gives you some idea of where, and I want to particularly credit Professor David Schultz from Hammond University for this slide, because I think it does a pretty good job of laying out where we have principles that and how we trace them back and to the Magna Carta. Now, when we talk about origin stories, and here I want to go into a little more detail about the rule of law, custom, tradition, and norms are important in a way in which written documents, while they're relevant and interesting and useful, are also important. French philosopher, lawyer, author Tocqueville makes a visit to the United States and writes a two-volume set of observations about what he saw here, sort of cabined together as democracy in America. And one of the stories he tells in this book, or actually two books published several years apart, is about observing civil jury trials in jury trials in a rural part of America. And, you know, this was in an era in which judges and lawyers travel together, arrive in town. The lawyers would be retained to deal with particular legal issues. Cases would be tried before a jury of their peers. Judgments would be rendered. The judgments would be followed. And then the judges and lawyers would pick up and move on to the next town. This is exactly what Lincoln's law practice looked like in his early days. And actually, David Davis, who was often a judge in these proceedings, was part of this traveling parade. And Tocqueville found this remarkable, the adherence to the rule of law. And there are other observations that he made that were pretty significant. And one of the reasons why, when we talk about Tocqueville, and I think he's particularly useful here, is because he says, he makes these observations, but if you know his history, his great-grandfather was the lawyer designated to defend Louis XVI. And ultimately, both his great-grandfather and Louis XVI are executed by the French revolutionaries. The American experience of the rule of law is something very different. And when you don't have rule of law, you then have the potential for these kinds of tragedies. I actually had a brief experience with a French general who came to our court one day and along with some others from the National Defense Institute, and asks a question about what is it if the government loses a criminal trial and the defendant's found not guilty, how often does the government appeal? I had to ask him to repeat the question twice because I couldn't figure out what he was talking about. And then I realized in the French model, there is no such thing as double jeopardy. But that is a right that exists here in a way in which you don't find in other systems. Next slide. Let's talk a little bit about threats to the rule of law. Next slide. So we've been in an interesting environment lately where we talk about partisanship being a significant problem. And I don't mean to minimize it. I think we are in a very partisan environment. I think it's probably a more partisan environment than the environment that I grew up in the 50s and maybe mid 60s. Maybe not so much as we get to the late 60s. I'll talk about that in a minute. But But it is not the first time for us to have partisanship issues. And I just sort of randomly picked one era, in this case, 1876 to 1896. And I noted some characteristics in that era. For example, between 1876 and 1896, no presidential candidate won a majority of the votes. There were three presidential assassinations, Lincoln, Garfield, and McKinley. Seven members or former members of Congress were assassinated between 1865 and 1905. Now, we've had some debate over the last little while, really going back to some earlier times and questions about how balloting should occur and so forth. Many people are surprised to learn that the secret ballot that we properly treat as an important part of the American electoral experience, not provided for in the Constitution of the United States. It is in fact something that did not exist until the 1880s. I believe it comes over here from Australia, and I think we originally referred to it as the Australian ballot. And if you think we have fraud problems now, imagine political parties handing out ballots and then those ballots being collected as a way to determine who won. When we talk about, some of these very close presidential elections and winning by, several thousand votes and so forth, who knows? So there are lots of aspects of our history that when we talk about the rule of law, we assume today's circumstances apply ante, and in fact, often they don't. Next slide. Legislative and executive branch power. So we know from Alexander Hamilton, Federalist 78, that the judiciary is to be the least dangerous branch. And had certain limited taxing power and authority over state government, certainly more power than we had in the Articles of Confederation, but less than perhaps, certainly monarchical regimes had. Next slide. But those powers have been colliding for a while. And here again, I return to a theme that I have mentioned earlier and I will be mentioning again, which is in the ancient words of Ecclesiastes, there is nothing new under the sun. So we all know about Marbury, right? The two cousins, John Marshall, Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court, and Thomas Jefferson, President of the United States, were adverse on this issue. And ultimately, the Supreme Court issues an opinion written by Marshall that says, yes, there is such a thing as judicial review, which incidentally is not referenced in any documents. It's not referenced in the Constitution, for example. But unfortunately, poor Mr. Marbury doesn't get his certificate. And so there's nothing really for Jefferson to squawk about. To say that Jefferson was unhappy about this is certainly an understatement. Worcester versus Georgia, if you're looking for an example of a refusal on the part of a state to follow a court order. This is, of course, the famous United States Supreme Court decision. It presages the movement to push Native Americans west to deprive them of their rights. Georgia just basically says we're not going to follow it. So then we turn to Lincoln's first inaugural. And of course, Lincoln was adverse to the Supreme Court on Dred Scott and in several other ways. There were issues involving writs of habeas corpus, which I'm going to talk about in a minute. But he was sufficiently adverse that his first inaugural contains this language. If the policy of the government upon vital questions affecting the whole people is to be irrevocably fixed by decisions of the Supreme Court, the people will have ceased to be their own rulers. All right. Debate the merits of that language and how it applies and whatnot, but perhaps less articulately, with less magisterial language, you don't have to go very far to find presidents of the United States in the 20th and 21st session, 21st century, complaining about the Supreme Court using language very similar to that. And then, of course, we have ex parte Merriman. And here we have the writs of habeas corpus issues, which are raised not only in the Lincoln administration, but also in the administration of Franklin Roosevelt. Next slide. So not too long ago, we heard some conversation, I think in the last administration, about maybe we should reform the Supreme Court. This was not the first time this issue has come up. And of course, Roosevelt addresses this issue in his fireside chat of March 9, 1937, where he addresses his concerns about, as others might have characterized him, the nine old men on the Supreme Court getting in the way of his program. And he notes that the court has been acting not as a judicial body, but as a policymaking body. Have we heard this before? Has this come up before? I think it has. What's interesting about his effort to amend the Constitution, make changes to deal change way in which the body is constituted, is that he had super majorities in both the House and Senate and couldn't get it done. So the legislature although of his party, was unwilling to take this step. Next slide. But these are not the only rule of law issues that came up in those years. We talked about court packing, in re queering, which involved the arrival in the United States of several saboteurs, eight of them. And they were, I mean, I think it was a serious problem. It did have a little bit of the character of perhaps cartoon-like event, but it was a pretty serious matter, and he was treating it as a serious matter, and insisted that these were going to be tried by a military tribunal. And amidst all of this, there's a question of what happens if a writ of habeas corpus arrives at his doorstep. And there's a famous memo to Francis Biddle, his attorney general, saying, we're not turning these folks over if a writ shows up. Well, no writ showed up, so it turned out not to be an issue. But It is an illustration of these problems. Now, let me say a word about something that I didn't know about till a few years ago, and that were the Gold Clause cases. The citations are set out below, and also to an excellent law review article by Professor Jared Magliocca, who discusses the Gold Clause cases and constitutional necessity. I'm not going to go into this in great detail here because it takes a while, but essentially the argument was about whether or not contracts that had gold clauses in them could be repudiated by the government. These gold clauses were relevant because the economy was in a deflationary period. If people could insist on payment in gold, it would cause all kinds of economic issues. And in fact, there is a fireside chat prepared by President Roosevelt, which Professor Magliocca specifically recognizes, discusses, that, it would have been delivered had the Supreme Court come out differently. The Supreme Court didn't. In Perry and Nortz, the two citations that you see there, the Supreme Court, it actually looks very much like Marbury, if you think about this. It recognizes that these clauses exist, that they were valid, but they were ultimately unenforceable. And it does look very much like Marbury. And, we lose sight of these things because we weren't alive in this era. We didn't see it. We didn't hear it. It's something that legal scholars talk about. It sort of passed into history. It's sort of like campaigning. If you're not part of the time frame, you don't know, you don't see the campaigning in a way in which you can compare it to today. But in fact, Wendell Willkie, or one of Willkie's advisors, part of the Willkie campaign, referred to Roosevelt as the Bolshevik in the White House. And of course, Roosevelt Roosevelt ran against Herbert Hoover in all four of his elections, even though Hoover had not served as president of the United States since 1933. And Truman, in his campaign, his one successful campaign for president, characterized his opponents as Nazis. I mean, so the kind of language that we decry today, it's not exactly unheard of. Interesting fact about Truman, by the way, is when he becomes president, who does he look to help with relief in Europe? Against the advice of some of the Roosevelt partisans in the White House, who, as I said earlier, had been running against Truman running against Hoover all those years, he looks to Herbert Hoover. Hoover, of course, had been very successful in World War I in providing relief to folks in Europe who were starving as a result of the war. And he reprised that role for Harry Truman in 1946 and the years that followed. And that's having slapped Truman around a little bit here. I'm crediting him for that. He recognized that it was important to do that. Next slide. All right, let's talk briefly in the few minutes that I have left here about other challenges to the rule of law. I happen to think judicial elections are a major problem. By judicial elections, I'm speaking here sort of generically. I think there's a sort of ladder of how big the challenge is depending on the type of judicial election process, and with partisan judicial elections at the top of the heap. But I think the distinction between partisan and nonpartisan judicial elections is receding into history, and they're all becoming partisan, or at least they are all becoming partisan in some states. Only 7 states have no judicial elections of any sort, all in the East. They draw their judicial election process from earlier British and United Kingdom traditions. 15 states have retention elections, and then the remaining 28 states have some judicial election process that's either partisan, nonpartisan, or both, depending on the court jurisdiction. And looking at it a different way, 38 states conduct some form of judicial elections for their state Supreme Court. Next slide. And of course, as we know, here in Minnesota, to the east of us, Wisconsin just finished, they have a off-season election cycle for judicial campaigns. $100 million was spent in that most recent Supreme Court race, if you add everything up. That's about twice what was spent 2 years ago. And, you have to ask yourself, where does it go from here? And we have seen increased judicial spending in a variety of different ways. And the problem, of course, with judicial elections is it creates concerns about whether or not the rule of law is applying here, or whether it's being treated as just another form of partisanship. I will say, just to defend my colleagues in various states that have judicial elections, Minnesota has them. We have not seen this kind of money spent, but we have seen at least a couple of election cycles where there was significant dollars spent, nothing on this order. Mine was, in fact, my one contested race in 2012 was an example of this. Quite a bit of money was spent in that race. And I would never argue that it actually reflects an unwillingness to abide by the rule of law, but perception can become reality, and that is a real problem in judicial elections. Next slide. So there are some other challenges. I didn't solve the judicial election problem for you. That's a separate program, we could talk at great length about what alternatives have been discussed. None of them have worked well or perfectly, and we have a lot to do there. All right, some other challenges. How many federal crimes has Congress created? We don't know. Nobody knows. George Mason University and the Heritage Foundation estimated approximately 5,200 crimes, but there's no comprehensive list. And that estimate does not include crimes created by rule. The Code of Federal Regulations now exceeds 175,000 pages. Now, if I were doing this program live, I would have with you, or with you here today, as we're visiting, my one volume 1866 copy of Minnesota statutes. That was all the laws of Minnesota in that era. It's now, if you add in the regulations and sort of the other pieces, it's somewhere between 40 and 50 volumes. I actually haven't tried to count the number of volumes. I probably should do that. It's a lot. And if you can't know all the law, are you undercutting the rule of law? Really good question to which I don't have an answer. Next question. So what about crimes that that are created by regulation? This is an example of one that I get from the very useful X feed, Twitter feed, whatever we're calling it, the crime of day. And this one is the federal pie and tart divide. You can read it for yourself. You better make clear about the distinction between your frozen cherry pie or your frozen cherry tart, because it may well be a crime. Next slide. So I think this is one of the least explored, but maybe most important challenges to the rule of law, and that's the collapsing nature of civic education in the United States, particularly in the elementary and secondary environment. 75% of Americans can't name all three branches of government. 37% of Americans can't name one First Amendment right. And the National Assessment of Educational Progress, which is probably the closest thing we have to a gold standard to determine the accuracy of or to determine what progress we're making with history and civics, tells us that 13% of eighth graders were proficient in history and 20% of eighth graders were proficient in civics. And those numbers haven't changed in 25 years. This is not a new problem. COVID may have made it worse, but it's a significant issue. Lawyers, incidentally, can be very helpful in volunteering and working with students in this area. And maybe we'll talk about that if I have a moment. Next slide. Well, where do we go? Where do we go from here? Next slide. I want to offer a couple of suggestions here. One ties back to that last slide that I talked about, which is on a retail level, lawyers of all stripes, all beliefs, you know, whatever political parties you might belong to or support, or whatever kind of law practice you have, you're in a really good position to be spending time with middle school and high school students if you can persuade local teachers to let you assist to come in and talk about some of these issues. It really makes a difference. There are challenges to that, but I offer that as one suggestion. But there's some other things that we maybe want to think about. I'm not going to talk about administrative law here. I've got a great quote that if I had a little more time, I would read to you that that gives you some indication of the problems that it presents. But we might have an opportunity for some reform here. Now, note the point that I make here about taking advantage of January 2020, 2029. What do I mean by that? In 2028, there will be a presidential election that will result in the election of somebody who is, there's no second term. It's going to be somebody who is not currently serving as president. And I think there might be some advantages here in terms of encouraging some bipartisan ways of addressing some issues. People have, you've got your own list of issues. Other people have a list of issues. Let me give you an example of what I mean by this. In both of the last two presidencies, the current one and the preceding one, and going backwards, I guess, all the way to the Clinton years, there have been concerns about presidential exercise of the pardon power. It seems to me that you could put together a pretty good argument that would be, if we want to make some changes in the form of a constitutional amendment, this would be the time for Congress to pass such a thing and send it to the states. For example, Robert Grayboys, who's a retired professor from Columbia, I believe, originally, has given an example of this. He says, well, let's have a 90-day public comment period before any pardon can take effect. And that would take you back to the end of October. So controversial pardons, there'd be a public discussion and a public referendum on whether or not the voters are offended by any particular pardon. Now, maybe you have to run that back to 120 because of increasing use of early election provisions. But that's an example of an idea that maybe you could sell both political parties, knowing that nobody knows what party will be in control of the White House. Maybe true of some administrative procedure issues and also ethics and disclosure provisions. Next slide. So where I've sat on the bench for 19 years and change, in a building designed by Cass Gilbert, who also designed many years later, the United States Supreme Court building. If you ever get a chance to see the Minnesota Courthouse and the United States Supreme Court House, if you compare them, there actually are some similarities. But the door that you come in and out of that courtroom, in addition to having a clock that most of the time actually works, there's a line from one of John Locke's many writings, in this case, his second treatise on government, where it says, "Where law ends, tyranny begins." And I thought that was a great way to end this seminar. All of us who are participating here today are believers in the rule of law. We may have varying opinions about how do we go about preserving it, but when we consider the roots, how it's been used, and the challenges that we faced over the last 200 years, I'm actually an optimist that we're going to continue prosper, and we're going to continue to prosper because the rule of law is going to continue to be an important process for us in that effort. Much more could be said about this topic, but I've been told to quit at 12:49. It is now 12:49. So thank you all for being with us over the this period of time, and I'll take whatever questions Professor McGinnis sends my way.
Thank you, Justice Center, for that truly informative and excellent presentation. So we do have some questions in the chat, so I'm going to go in the Q&A, I should say. And I'm going to go through and take a look at, I'll pick this one. An independent judiciary is meant to guarantee impartiality, yet in practice, the pressures of judicial efficiency and docket management can work against that ideal, especially when courts face limited time and resources. How do you see the balance between public perception of the court's role and the court's actual operations being improved to strengthen confidence in its impartiality and effectiveness? And it says capital C court, so I presume it's referring to the U.S. Supreme Court primarily.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and I don't I think the volume of case law or the volume of matters that courts have to deal with, either the United States Supreme Court, but also I want to focus on our district courts, because the reality is that when most citizens have a legal dispute, I mean, that's their window into the rule of law. I mean, how was the case handled? What do they have a sense that it was handled fairly? A lot of that is driven by some of the issues that the questioner mentions here, which is when I started practicing in 1979, you would have the opportunity for, pretty long conversations with district court judges, summary judgment motions, other motions, but also informally in many respects. A lot of that has vanished as the number of cases that courts are asked to decide. And so I think what the questioner is raising here, that has a corrosive effect on the rule of law. And I think the answer really is that at the retail level, we've got to be explaining to legislators and to candidates for governor, because it's mostly a state court issue, I think, but it's It's also a federal court issue, but I see it as a state court issue because that's where most of these cases get decided. And you've got a contract case, a divorce, questions about whether or not children were cared for properly. These are the ways in which people form opinions about courts. And if they see the process as we're just part of an assembly line to get this file moved from here to there, that's terrible for the image of the rule of law. And the only way to deal with that is more resources and more judges. And that's going to be as popular as you might expect with legislators. There are no votes to be had for legislators by providing additional funding to courts. I can tell you that after spending 25 years visiting with legislators on that very topic.
Well, thank you, Justice Anderson. I much appreciate that response. So another question we have is regarding In Re Quirin, and just asking if you know whether some of the German saboteurs were executed before the court's decision rejecting their claims, before that was a publicly issued opinion. Do you know the answer to that?
I don't recall, to be honest. Okay. I would be guessing on that, and I should know the answer to that question, and I don't. I think the executions occurred after the opinion came out, but I'm not 100% certain. Somebody will look it up and tell me if I'm wrong.
No, thank you very much. I'm not sure the answer to that either, so I appreciate that. Another question we have is, do you agree that the need for congressional term limits is the most important amendment we need, I guess a constitutional amendment? Do you think that relates to what we're talking about with regard to rule of law?
No, I've had varied opinions on this. I had some exposure to partisan politics 40 years ago or 35 years ago. I think expansive term limits probably are a good idea. I think some of the term limits that you see proposed, 6 years for the House and 2 terms for the Senate, run the risk of handing over operation of the government to the permanent administrative class. I would say that if you start talking about maybe 12 years in the House and maybe 3 terms in the Senate or something along those lines, I could see it as very beneficial. But the problem is, I think the institutional problems with Congress are its increasing parliamentary approach as opposed to institutional loyalty. We can always overstate the amount of institutional loyalty, but Roosevelt had all kinds of problems in the example that I cited with members of the House and Senate who were not willing to go along with changing the Supreme Court, even though they were in the same party. Would you get that same pushback today? I don't know the answer to that question. And I don't know how you build that institutional loyalty. Which is one of the reasons why I think maybe starting slowly with some of these ideas that maybe you can get going with more simple concepts might have some merit.
Thank you very much for that. Next question I want to pose, one of our attendees has asked, to the extent that courts increasingly weigh in on political questions and appear to resolve cases on political bases, is not some level of political accountability, such as via retention, election, or recall, justifiable?
That is a great question, and it is a very fair question. And I have to tell you that when I was busy arguing, I was a member of the Quay Commission, as you referenced in your overgenerous introduction of me. And the commission came very close to passing this thing. It was a provision to move to a retention model in Minnesota combined with a very robust performance evaluation process. We couldn't quite get it across the finish line. But one of the best arguments against that process is what you've just cited here, which is an increasingly complex world. If we're asking judges to make, or judges take to themselves to make, political decisions, why isn't there political accountability? I think that's a great question, and it's a great argument against the argument that I just made, which is I think the threat to judicial impartiality is greater than the threat of absence of political accountability. But people of good faith and intelligence can disagree on that question. And all I can tell your questioner there is it's he or she is not wrong that it's an issue.
Thank you for that. I know kind of a corollary.
You know, one way to deal with that too might be when you talk about term limits, for example, and Minnesota has a mandatory retirement of age 70 for judges. And I actually think, again, that may be a way to maybe if you don't have people serving for 45 years or whatever, maybe that helps that process a little bit. But I don't know.
No, thank you for that. There's actually a corollary type of question that someone's posed. Should we maintain life tenure when justices make political decisions despite their job security, referring to federal life tenure under Article 3? And that's this idea that the idea of the insulation from review and being able to have life security, promoting independence, the ideas are supposed to be free of political pressure. But if you're actually making decisions, or it appears that from your opinions that you're writing from a very much a policy-driven political standpoint, perhaps, that's one reason people could call that into question.
And this becomes, is this a potential area where I suspect there's too much division to actually get here, but how you'd construct term limits, for example, if it's a 15 or 20 year term for a state Supreme Court justice. And I think there's at least one state that has something like that. I have to think about which one it is right offhand. But, maybe there's an argument for that. The problem with, retirement ages is that you then put the political parties in the field of, well, then we're going to just make sure we appoint judges who are younger and younger to maximize their time on the bench. Now, one thing I want to stress with folks when we talk about these questions, we're debating this as if this is something new. If you go back to Roosevelt's appointments to the court, I mean, who does he appoint? Hugo Black. Black is a loyal senator for Roosevelt's New Deal. He turns out, and of course, there are some aspects of his background that we've discussed that are also somewhat challenging. But he turns out to be a somewhat complicated member of the court in terms of his adherence to sort of democratic small d political party principles. He turns out to be perhaps not exactly what Roosevelt had in mind, but that was what he was doing, was appointing somebody who he thought saw the world that he did. So these questions about judicial appointments are not new. And they are questions that, I don't have any independent research into this, but I'm very certain that when Lincoln was looking at appointments to the Supreme Court, he was interested in appointing people who thought Dred Scott was a really bad idea. And I would note that one of his appointments was David Davis, his judge that he regularly appeared in front of in Illinois, and who was the chair of his campaign at the Republican National Committee in Chicago in 1860. And famously, when Lincoln gave his stuffy instructions to David Davis that he was to make no deals in his name, Davis's response to somebody who inquired about whether or not Davis was going to follow Lincoln's instructions was to say, Lincoln's not here. So I mean, some of these things are not new.
That's very good. Well, excellent. We're now out of time, and just so much appreciate, Justice Anderson, your presentation, and thank you for everything you've done through your career, through giving back, through sharing ideas about from your experience and wisdom. It's been a privilege to moderate this program for you. I'll give it back to Kayla.
And I'll echo those thanks. Really appreciate you both taking this section of your days and sharing your expertise and insight. Thanks also to our audience for joining and participating. We welcome listener feedback by email at fedsocforums@fedsoc.org. And as always, keep an eye on our website and your emails for announcements about other upcoming virtual events. With that, thank you all for joining us today. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FedSoc Forums, a podcast of the Federal Society's Practice Groups. For more information about the Federal Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federal Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.